3.1. Let me now turn to the socialists. Can the socialists ignore the problem arising out of the social order? The socialists of India, following their fellows in Europe, are seeking to apply the economic interpretation of history to the facts of India. They propound that man is an economic creature, that his activities and aspirations are bound by economic facts, that property is the only source of power. They therefore preach that political and social reforms are but gigantic illusions, and that economic reform by equalization of property must have precedence over every other kind of reform. One may join issue with every one of these premises on which rests the socialists' case for economic reform as having priority over every other kind of reform. One may contend that the economic motive is not the only motive by which man is actuated. That economic power is the only kind of power no student of human society can accept. 3.2. That the social status of an individual by itself often becomes a source of power and authority is made clear by the sway which the Mahatmas have held over the common man. Why do millionaires in India obey penniless sadhus and fakirs? Why do millions of paupers in India sell their trifling trinkets which constitute their only wealth and go to Banaras and Mecca? That religion is the source of power is illustrated by the history of India, where the priest holds sway over the common man often greater than that of the magistrate, and where everything, even such things as strikes and elections, so easily takes a religious turn and can so easily be given a religious twist. 3.3. Take the case of the plebeians of Rome as a further illustration of the power of religion over man. It throws great light on this point. The plebeians had fought for a share in the supreme executive under the Roman Republic and had secured the appointment of a plebeian consul elected by a separate electorate constituted by the Comitia Centuriata, which was an assembly of plebeians. They wanted a consul of their own because they felt that the patrician consuls used to discriminate against the plebeians in carrying on the administration. They had apparently obtained a great gain because under the Republican Constitution of Rome, one consul had the power of vetoing an act of the other consul. 3.4. But did they in fact gain anything? The answer to this question must be in the negative. The plebeians never could get a plebeian consul who could be said to be a strong man and who could act independently of the patrician consul. In the ordinary course of things, the plebeians should have got a strong plebeian consul in view of the fact that his election was to be by a separate electorate of plebeians. The question is, why did they fail in getting a strong plebeian to officiate as their consul? 3.5. The answer to this question reveals the dominion which religion exercises over the minds of men. It was an accepted creed of the whole Roman populace that no official could enter upon the duties of his office unless the oracle of Delphi declared that he was acceptable to the goddess. The priests who were in charge of the temple of the goddess of Delphi were all patricians. Whenever, therefore, the plebeians elected a consul who was known to be a strong party man and opposed to the patricians, or communal, to use the term that is current in India, the oracle invariably declared that he was not acceptable to the goddess. This is how the plebeians were cheated out of their rights. 3.6. But what is worthy of note is that the plebeians permitted themselves to be thus cheated because they too, like the patricians, held firmly the belief that the approval of the goddess was a condition precedent to the taking charge by an official of his duties, and that election by the people was not enough. If the plebeians had contended that election was enough and that the approval by the goddess was not necessary, they would have derived the fullest benefit from the political right which they had obtained. But they did not. They agreed to elect another less suitable to themselves but more suitable to the goddess, which in fact meant more amenable to the patricians. Rather than give up religion, the plebeians gave up the material gain for which they had fought so hard. Does this not show that religion can be a source of power as great as money, if not greater? 3.7. The fallacy of the socialists lies in supposing that because in the present stage of European society, property as a source of power is predominant, the same is true of India, or the same was true of Europe in the past. Religion, social status and property are all sources of power and authority which one man has to control the liberty of another. One is predominant at one stage, the other is predominant at another stage. That is the only difference. If liberty is the ideal, and if liberty means the destruction of the dominion which one man holds over another, then obviously it cannot be insisted upon that economic reform must be the one kind of reform worthy of pursuit. If the source of power and dominion is, at any given time or in any given society, social and religious, then social reform and religious reform must be accepted as the necessary sort of reform. 3.8. One can thus attack the doctrine of economic interpretation of history adopted by the socialists of India. But I recognize that the economic interpretation of history is not necessary for the validity of the socialist contention that equalization of property is the only real reform and that it must precede everything else. However, what I would like to ask the socialists is this: can you have economic reform without first bringing about a reform of the social order? The socialists of India do not seem to have considered this question. I do not wish to do them an injustice. I give below a quotation from a letter which a prominent socialist wrote a few days ago to a friend of mine, in which he said, "I do not believe that we can build up a free society in India so long as there is a trace of this ill-treatment and suppression of one class by another. Believing as I do in a socialist ideal, inevitably I believe in perfect equality in the treatment of various classes and groups. I think that socialism offers the only true remedy for this as well as other problems." 3.9. Now the question that I would like to ask is it enough for a socialist to say, "I believe in perfect equality in the treatment of the various classes"? To say that such a belief is enough is to disclose a complete lack of understanding of what is involved in socialism. If socialism is a practical program and is not merely an ideal, distant and far off, the question for a socialist is not whether he believes in equality. The question for him is whether he minds one class ill-treating and suppressing another class as a matter of system, as a matter of principle, and thus allow tyranny and oppression to continue to divide one class from another. 3.10. Let me analyze the factors that are involved in the realization of socialism in order to explain fully my point. Now it is obvious that the economic reform contemplated by the socialists cannot come about unless there is a revolution resulting in the seizure of power. That seizure of power must be by a proletariat. The first question I ask is, will the proletariat of India combine to bring about this revolution? What will move men to such an action? It seems to me that, other things being equal, the only thing that will move one man to take such an action is the feeling that other men with whom he is acting are actuated by feelings of equality and fraternity and, above all, of justice. Men will not join in a revolution for the equalization of property unless they know that after the revolution is achieved, they will be treated equally and that there will be no discrimination of caste and creed. 3.11. The assurance of a socialist leading the revolution that he does not believe in caste, I am sure, will not suffice. The assurance must be the assurance proceeding from a much deeper foundation, namely the mental attitude of the compatriots towards one another in their spirit of personal equality and fraternity. Can it be said that the proletariat of India, poor as it is, recognizes no distinctions except that of the rich and the poor? Can it be said that the poor in India recognize no such distinctions of caste or creed, high or low? If the fact is that they do, what unity of front can be expected from such a proletariat in its actions against the rich? How can there be a revolution if the proletariat cannot present a united front? 3.12. Suppose, for the sake of argument, that by some freak of fortune, a revolution does take place and the socialists come into power. Will they not have to deal with the problems created by the particular social order prevalent in India? I can't see how a socialist state in India can function for a second without having to grapple with the problems created by the prejudices which make Indian people observe the distinctions of high and low, clean and unclean. If socialists are not to be content with the mouthing of fine phrases, if the socialists wish to make socialism a definite reality, then they must recognize that the problem of social reform is fundamental and that for them there is no escape from it. 3.13. That the social order prevalent in India is a matter which a socialist must deal with, that unless he does so, he cannot achieve his revolution, and that if he does achieve it as a result of good fortune, he will have to grapple with the social order if he wishes to realize his ideal, is a proposition which, in my opinion, is incontrovertible. He will be compelled to take account of caste after the revolution if he does not take account of it before the revolution. This is only another way of saying that, turn in any direction you like, caste is the monster that crosses your path. You cannot have political reform, you cannot have economic reform unless you kill this monster.